Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
Israeli troops and tanks have gone into the Gaza Strip. Israel's strategy is becoming clearer.
Essentially, we are seeing the gradual encirclement of the northern half of the Strip in a very methodical way that is built around prioritizing slow progress, cautious progress over speed and shock.
Meanwhile, the death toll in Gaza now tops 8,000. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We visit a hospital in Latvia where kids from Ukraine can get away from war.
I am feeling like free because you don't think about rockets, you don't think about basements. I can just chill out here.
And the death of actor Matthew Perry is being felt by global fans who connected to the characters in Friends.
I start to feel that like they are actually my friends.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. The Israeli military says it rescued an Israeli soldier overnight from inside the Gaza Strip. She had been taken hostage on October 7th and is now reunited with her family. More than 200 people are still believed to be held hostage in Gaza. Hamas released a short video today showing three of them, all women. One speaks to the camera, addressing the Israeli prime minister directly. It's not clear how much duress she was under while making the statement.
Bibi Netanyahu Shalom.
She tells Benjamin Netanyahu to release Palestinian prisoners so she and the other hostages can go free. Netanyahu's office released the names of the three women and said they're being used for cruel propaganda by Hamas. Speaking to the foreign press today, Netanyahu said he's doing what he can to free the hostages. He also ruled out agreeing to a ceasefire.
Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas. To surrender to terrorism, to surrender to barbarism. That will not happen.
Inside the Gaza Strip, the situation for much of the Palestinian population has gotten worse. Abul Okal is a Palestinian American there with no way out. In a voice message, he told us that Israeli bombing was intense last night.
40 of us are all sheltering in the same house, including many children and 10 Americans. If we can't find an alternative source of water tomorrow, we'd have no choice but to turn to the unfiltered or unprocessed well water, which in normal days is considered non-drinkable water.
Over the weekend, Israeli ground forces entered the Gaza Strip. Shashank Joshi is defense editor at The Economist. I spoke with him earlier today and asked what we know so far about the Israeli military's moves in Gaza.
I think many people expected an all-out offensive that would see massed forces cut right across the strip quickly. What's happened is what you might call an incremental invasion. We saw Israeli forces move into Gaza in the very far north, Beit Hanun, and in the midpoint of the strip, Burej. And in the last hours or so, we've seen Israeli forces reach the outskirts of Gaza City, particularly on a key north-south road that connects the northern part of Gaza, where they're operating, with the southern half of the territory where they have told civilians to go. So essentially, we are seeing the gradual encirclement of the northern half of the strip in a very methodical way that is built around prioritizing slow progress, cautious progress over speed and shock.
Mm. So now the Israeli military has moved into parts of the territory around Gaza City. What's the military strategy here to that encirclement?
Gaza is 50 kilometers long. It's a territory of over 2 million people. It's pretty densely populated. I think the IDF is trying to essentially focus on parts of Gaza at a time so that they can identify Hamas's leadership, its arms caches, its tunnels, which of course are very extensive underneath the strip. They stretch to about 500 kilometers worth of tunnels, over 1,300 of them, according to public estimates. And I think they're trying to essentially clear one bit at a time. And once they have cleared it, they can use that section as a kind of stronghold from which to then conduct further operations.
So if they do stay there, and this turns out to be a longer term siege with Israeli forces, you know, inside of northern Gaza, what will that mean for the civilians who didn't leave or couldn't leave that northern portion of the strip?
From, you know, the estimates we have, we would say at least a third of civilians have stayed in northern Gaza. So what it means for them is they will be in the midst of some very intense urban fighting. Roughly 10% of Gaza's housing stock has been destroyed. Around 280,000 Palestinian civilians may not have homes to return to after this war is over, given the levels of destruction as of now.
10% of houses, wow. The Israelis talk about destroying the military infrastructure of Hamas, especially the underground tunnels. How accurately can the Israeli military pinpoint these tunnels?
I don't think it's easy. You can identify the entrances of tunnels to a degree by observing mobile phone signals, electronic intelligence to see where Hamas fighters are moving. You can even use things like ground-penetrating radar to observe structures underground. But just because you can identify those doesn't mean you can destroy them easily. You can try putting explosive substances into the tunnel. The IDF used something that was a gel-like explosive in 2014. But on average, a tunnel required about 9 to 11 tons of this stuff to destroy. And you can imagine, you know, the logistical demands of moving 11 tons of gel into the middle of an urban area and then sitting there at the entrances while you stick it in. And I have to say, even if you give the IDF months and months, I struggle to see how it really is going to be able to destroy an underground network of this scale and scope.
It sounds like the tunnels are a big asset for Hamas in this war. Can you tell me more about what they could do with them?
I mean, originally these were for smuggling from Egypt, but over time Hamas realized they could use these for storing weapons, protecting commanders, providing an alternative means of communication because the Israelis control the telephone and internet networks, and so they can eavesdrop on those. But also, most usefully perhaps, conducting ambushes. So effectively, if you were thinking about the Israeli way of war is relying on aerial surveillance, drones, jets, satellites, and precision weapons, going underground is a way to neutralize that technological edge your opponent has over you. It's a way of hiding from drones, hiding from satellites, hiding from precision bombs, because you can't see easily underground.
Would Hamas fighters be able to escape from Gaza entirely and flee to Egypt through the tunnels?
I think that's a great question. I don't know the answer for sure. We know that Egypt is concerned about Hamas. It doesn't like Hamas, of course. But at the same time, they don't have full control of the crossings and that area, because on the other side of Gaza is the Sinai Peninsula. Islamic State has been very active in the Sinai Peninsula in recent years. Egyptian military and security forces don't have great coverage of that area. And so I suspect if Hamas fighters were eager to escape, some of them could do so from the south. I think one indication that that is a sensitive area is the warning by Egypt in recent days to the Israelis saying, do not bomb the routes to the south of Gaza. We will treat that as a hostile act. And I think that suggests the Egyptians must be worried that Israel might be considering doing so.
So we've been talking about how a long-term siege of northern Gaza is likely to be catastrophic for civilians. Do these growing calls for a ceasefire and international pressure on Israel make this gradual approach very risky?
I think they do. On the one hand, it represents a balance between trying to target Hamas and trying to allow space for hostage diplomacy, because, of course, there are still 220 estimated hostages inside Gaza held by Hamas. And this more methodical approach may be intended to try to reduce levels of civilian destruction compared to an all-out assault. But on the other hand, if this war is elongated and fought for months, that's going to bring cascading pressure on Israel. Of course, the most important audience is the United States, which is Israel's key military partner. And if you are sitting in the White House, do you want this campaign to stretch into an election year in which many of your progressive democratic base are deeply hostile to this Israeli war and want it to end? And so I think the Israelis do face a dilemma between taking their time and doing this cautiously and slowly, and on the other hand, realizing that every previous Israeli war in history, in a way, has been fought hard and fast, with the shadow of an impending ceasefire putting pressure on Israeli leaders.
The Economist defense editor Shashank Joshi joined us from London. He's been telling us about the strategy and tactics behind Israel's ground offensive in Gaza. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
As the war between Israel and Hamas escalates, we're seeing its effects ripple across the globe. Yesterday, in Russia's southern republic of Dagestan, a mob stormed the airport searching for Israelis and Jews. 20 people were injured and authorities made dozens of arrests. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports.
As the riot unfolded in Makhachkala, Dagestan's capital, videos began popping up on social media in real time. Hundreds of men broke through the main entrance and pushed their way past security. Many of them were carrying Palestinian flags. The crowd rushed through the terminal and made its way onto the tarmac. According to media reports, the riot was instigated by social media posts where people were told that a flight from Tel Aviv would be arriving with Israeli passengers. The man in the video is saying we're checking cars, documents, and passports. They were looking for Israelis. They didn't find any. Zev Levine is a historian at the Truman Research Institute at Hebrew University, where he studies the Muslim communities of the former Soviet Union.
Taking over an airfield, it's something unprecedented in Russian political history. I can't remember anything like it happening in modern Russia.
Russia's aviation agency now says that security has been restored. They also say that the airport will reopen tomorrow, but flights from Israel will be temporarily redirected to other cities. Levin says that the riot at the Makhachkala airport didn't happen in a vacuum.
The unquestionable stand of Russia against Israel influenced a lot the public opinion there and brought the mob into the streets.
Levin notes that any public action right now in Russia is unusual, especially since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. In recent weeks, though, Levin says that some pro-Palestinian protests have been taking place in Russia. As for the riot at the Makhachkala airport, Hanna Nota, a Russia security expert at the Middlebury Institute, doubts that the Kremlin was behind it.
At this time, when Russia is fighting a war against Ukraine, I doubt that they want to have another headache in the North Caucasus by letting anti-Semitic and Islamist sentiments getting too much out of control.
Nota believes that the riot got out of hand because security services were taken by surprise. But she also says that the Kremlin's politics created an atmosphere where such an event could happen.
This is really a manifestation of the Kremlin reaping what it sowed with its heavy pro-Palestinian messaging over the last few weeks, letting anti-Semitism go viral on Russian state media, calling out disloyal Jews who left for Israel.
Nota says that Moscow's pro-Palestinian approach goes back decades to the Soviet Union. But she says that today that position is even more pronounced.
Russia never characterized what transpired on October 7th as terrorism. It has not publicly censured Hamas. And indeed, last week, we saw a Hamas delegation arriving in Moscow only 2 weeks after this vicious attack on October 7th.
On top of not condemning Hamas, Russia has consistently accused the U.S. of enabling the current crisis between Israelis and Palestinians. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova has repeated this frequently.
Сколько там всего американцы наразвертывали? Сколько своих баз? Сколько своих экспертов? Сколько спутников?
While speaking to the press last week, Zakharova blamed the U.S., saying that despite its military might, it was unable to prevent bloodshed from happening. According to Note, Moscow's stance isn't just about its opposition to the U.S.
Russia would benefit from a protracted war between Israel and Hamas, but one that stays geographically confined.
For Russia, any event that draws attention away from Ukraine is seen as a win. The Kremlin also hopes that funding for Ukraine will shrink as countries shift their focus to the Middle East. But ultimately, according to Nota, Russia doesn't want the war between Israel and Hamas to get out of hand and stretch closer to its borders. A regional war would undermine Russian interests and would be too close for comfort. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman in Riga, Latvia.
Daniel will be back with us again later this hour with a report on a Riga hospital program that's helping Ukrainian kids. Just ahead, the global reach of 620-somethings in New York City as fans around the world remember actor Matthew Perry. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World.
Nadie te dijo que la vida fuera así.
This tune is unmistakable to fans around the world, even if they may be used to hearing it in a different language. It's the theme song for Friends, which has been broadcast in more than 100 countries. The TV show is why the actor Matthew Perry is being mourned around the world today after his death over the weekend. Perry's character, Chandler Bing, was part of an international phenomenon. Michelle Nunez is a fan from Caracas, Venezuela.
I think we all had a soft spot for Chandler. You can feel like we all lost an old friend, like a high school friend. It was truly painful, I think, for many of us. We love you, Matthew.
Many global fans credit Friends with helping them practice English, with interesting results. This is Syrian journalist Asma Al-Omar.
When I started working in journalism, I remember one of the journalists said that the way that he described my English was by saying that I spoke Friends. And while that was quite offensive, I quite thought that it was very endearing, just given how much I loved that show growing up.
In Beijing, Yolanda Leung is also thinking about why an American TV show from the 90s means so much to her now.
I just love the vibe, like how those six people, you know, live their lives together, you know, facing different kinds of difficulties, looking out for each other, their relationship, their friendship, their how they grow up in their relationship, those kind of things. It just has huge impacts on me, and I start to feel like I'm like the seventh friend among them. Yeah, so that's why I like the show.
So you were watching this as a college student in Beijing. Was there anything, you know, about American culture or English that you learned from this show? Or was it really more about, you know, something you wanted to perhaps emulate in relationships?
It's not like I watched the show to study English or something like that. But it's like unintentionally, as I watched the show, you know, for many times, I start to learn more about America and the way people are left there, you know, their expressions, their way of talking, those kind of things. Yeah, so it does help me that way.
So Matthew Perry's character specifically, Chandler Bing, was sarcastic and had this very specific style of speaking. Are there any lines or jokes of his that have stuck with you?
It always starts with, could there be more? Yeah, it's always when I have like conversation with my friends here in China, sometimes when the situation like have a deja vu, I just felt like speaking that way. So it's just stick with me.
And so how did you react when you found out that Matthew Perry had died?
I couldn't believe it. But then I start to check the push notifications and social media. It's like all over the place. And I just start crying. I cried for like an hour. I just couldn't hold it because I was, you know, in the meantime, browsing the social media, like seeing people are express their sadness and their shock. So it's pretty hard for me to get to know about the news.
Is there one scene that you've been remembering a lot with Matthew Perry in it?
Yeah, it's also like my favorite episode. It's when, you know, Ross had this thing and he's like hurrying everyone, you know, to leave the apartment. But then Chandler and Joey got into this fight.
Okay, buddy boy, here it is. You hide my clothes, I'm wearing everything you own.
Oh my God! That is so not the opposite of taking somebody's underwear.
Look at me. I'm Chandler. Could I be wearing any more clothes?
That one is super hilarious. And I just love how Joey and Chandler performed in that episode.
Yolanda Leung, a Friends superfan in Beijing, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
How do you study a country that you can't actually go to? This is the question facing Russian scholars and students at U.S. universities. As The World's Patty Daniels reports, it's not the first time that has been the case.
Harvard University marked the 75th anniversary of its Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies this weekend with a symposium on what we understand about Russia now, 20 months after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
We really started to think, you know, what does it mean to be studying a country and a region where Russia clearly has aggressive designs on of these other countries?
This is Alexandra Vakru. She's the executive director of the Davis Center. She says programs like Harvard's have seen clear inflection points going back to the mid-20th century.
The Davis Center was founded in 1948. It was designed to understand this new enemy that the United States had in the Cold War, the Soviet Union.
She uses the word enemy here deliberately.
And it was originally funded by grants from the CIA and also from the Carnegie Corporation and some other philanthropies in order to bring together a critical mass of experts in an attempt to understand it and figure out how dangerous it was going to be for the United States.
Fast forward to 1991, and everything changes for Soviet studies when the Soviet Union itself disappears. Researchers and scholars were suddenly able to travel freely and broadened their understanding of all the non-Russian people who comprised the USSR.
While there were some institutional similarities between them, because ministries were based in Moscow, for example, or Russian language was often the lingua franca in these different republics, they were quite different, and they were made part of a country somewhat involuntarily, and then all of a sudden they were independent. You didn't need all these complicated relationships with interests and minders and things like that. And it was really, in some ways, the golden age of rediscovering that part of the world.
Russia, Central Asia, the Baltics, the Caucasus, these are distinct regions that have all been lumped together in academic departments. This is something that bedevils universities still, especially since 2022, says Oksana Shevel. She's a Ukrainian political scientist at Tufts University, and she spoke at Harvard's weekend symposium.
The Russian invasion really opened the conversation in the field among scholars, and that resonates kind of conversations going on in the society back in that region. To what extent is it appropriate to call it Russian studies, right? And is this, in a way, even like a form of imperialism, because it subsumes many things that are not Russian, right, but which have been conventionally labeled as Russian?
When it comes to studying Russia itself, Vakru says the conditions now are reminiscent of the Cold War past.
So we did it in the Soviet Union, actually, right, without going there. So it's possible. We're meeting our friends like in airports, if we can arrange to have connections at the same time to talk to them, because Russians can't travel to the places that we travel to. Our memory of what it was like to study the Soviet Union and how difficult that was makes the determination to find new alternative techniques possible in a way that we would have never imagined, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago in 1991.
Academic work on Russia coming full circle here at Harvard and at other universities as well. For The World, I'm Patty Daniels, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. The musicians come from widely different parts of the world, spanning thousands of miles of geography, but in music they find a common language.
Basically, starting from China to the Arabic world, all of those countries, we have some common things that is really nice to play together.
The Aga Khan Master Musicians, ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of PRX and GBH in Boston. When Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, many countries stepped up their humanitarian aid. In Latvia, an organization called the Children's Hospital Foundation has been hosting groups of Ukrainian children and their families. They get 10 days of leisure, therapy, and a break from the war. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports.
When a new group of Ukrainian families arrives in Riga, they're greeted by Diana Klimchenko.
My name is Nika.
Nika.
Лера, очень приятно. Я Диана.
This group just arrived after a 30-hour bus ride from Kyiv to Riga. Klimchenko hugs the moms and their kids. She introduces herself, leads them to the hotel, and helps them check in.
Единственное, что я хочу понять, вы как голодные? На 6 часов вечера вам нормально будет ужин?
Are you hungry? Klimchenko asks. How does 6 o'clock dinner sound? Klimchenko is the lead organizer of this program, and she's been planning the itinerary for this group for weeks. How do you feel in this moment when they just come in? What's going through your mind?
It's more feelings. It's like waiting for some relatives, some people who are very, very close to my heart. Like my heart is opening up. This is what I feel.
Klimchenko says this is the fifth group that they've hosted in Latvia since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The kids taking part in this program are all patients at the Ochmadit Children's Hospital in Kyiv. Most of them are oncology patients in remission, but the focus of this program is not cancer.
Speaking with all these parents and doctors, it's just inevitable that every child in Ukraine is traumatized mentally, psychologically, emotionally by the war.
Klimchenko says that these families come from every part of Ukraine, including areas that were destroyed or were under Russian occupation. Many of the fathers of these kids are serving in the military. Some families have lost friends and loved ones. That's why mental health is the focus of this program in Latvia.
Different specialists are working with every age group, and also separate specialists is working with moms.
So there's therapy, but most of the day is devoted to travel and fun activities. They go to the pool, to museums, and walking tours around the city. On their second day in Latvia, the group visits a petting zoo. A little girl named Zlata and her mom Irina tell me to interview one of the rams. I try my best. For most of the younger kids, the baby goats are the fan favorites. They pet them, feed them, and ask their moms if they can bring them back to Ukraine. Maruta Shnore is one of the volunteers who works with the Ukrainian families.
This is one of the best type of psychological support because kids feel happy when they can feed animals, touch them, can contact with them. And sometimes I think it is more important than work with a psychologist.
Some of the older kids, though, seem a little less into petting the animals. 15-year-old Danya Sinchuk and his little brother Yehor are still talking about their 30-hour trip from Ukraine to Latvia.
My brother getting wild and start to hit me because he gets so boring and something like, my charge is low, so we're gonna fight. And the people that's sitting in front of us, we were angry at us because we always hitting their back.
I asked Yehor why he was picking fights with Danya.
Почему вы дрались?
Я не знаю, просто типа скучно было, наверное, больше.
And yeah, he says the same thing. He was just bored. But since arriving in Latvia, they've stopped fighting.
I think I'm gonna find more friends here, and it's very cool to be here because I am feeling like free because you don't think about rockets, you don't think about basements, I don't think about studying. I can just chill out here. It's really good.
Also, Danya doesn't have to think about being a cancer survivor, which is trauma on top of trauma. He, Yehor, and their mom, Kristina, are here together. This is only the second time they've left Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion.
Because of start of war, I'm be with my mom and brother, and my father be on the war.
Danya says his father was fighting on the front lines in eastern Ukraine. He's back home now, he says, but the war has taken its toll on him. After the war, he's become more aggressive, Danya says. I can't blame him. It's war. But he's still our dad. We love him just the way he is.
Знаете, я привезла с собой флаг подразделения, в котором воевал мой муж.
On the bus back to Riga, Кристина says her husband Вадим gave her a Ukrainian flag to bring with her to Latvia. The flag, she says, is signed by some of the guys who served in her husband's unit, but they all died, and her husband is struggling.
Он спит на полу, он не может спать на кровати.
He sleeps on the floor. He can't sleep on the bed, Кристина says. He hasn't unpacked his bag that he brought back with him from the front.
Физически он с нами, но психологически его с нами нет.
Physically he's with us, but psychologically he's somewhere else, Кристина says. He didn't really come back from the war. Кристина says she wishes her husband could have come to Latvia too, but he didn't want to leave Ukraine, even for a few days. She says she hasn't left completely either. She's a high school teacher, so many of her former students are now in the military, and they often send her text messages from the front lines. They tell her to have fun. That's what they're fighting for. A few days later, back at the hotel, Inga Gedrima is cleaning up Play-Doh after art therapy. She's one of the psychologists working with Ukrainian kids. Today was their third and final session together. Гедрима says that three sessions with kids isn't much, but it's enough to make some progress. She says her goal is to give each child tools that help them understand their emotions, especially when they go back to Ukraine. She also tries to build up their self-confidence. Гедрима says that after the first session, some of the kids told her that exploring their emotions is new to them. Даня says Гедрима inspired him.
She told me that I have like psychologist skills, and I really think about it a lot. And I think when I complete my college in Ukraine, I will go learn about psychology.
Даня says he's been sleeping better since he doesn't have to think about air raid sirens. He's also made some new friends.
I want to stay it like forever because it's my friends. All nights we just sit and play some truth or dare, and it's very cool to be here.
One thing he and his friends don't do is talk about what's happening back home.
We don't want to talk about war because we don't know anything of that, and anyway, we cannot change anything with kids, and we just think about when and what we're gonna do when the war ends.
On one of their last days in Latvia, the group has lunch at a Ukrainian restaurant. Кристина says she's enjoyed her time in Latvia, but at this point, she says she's eager to go back home. I sit at a table with Кристина, Ехор, and Даня. The waiters serve borscht, the Ukrainian national dish.
I want you to compare this borscht to the borscht you have at home, okay?
My mom cooks better.
But is it good?
Yeah, it's good, but like in Ukraine, it's better.
Кристина thanks Даня for the compliment. They all agree. Mom's borscht is better. For The World, in Riga, Latvia, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
It's been 5 days since Hurricane Otis smashed into the west coast of Mexico. It was a Category 5 storm and hit the city of Acapulco with wind speeds of 165 miles per hour. At least 48 people are now confirmed dead, with dozens more missing. 220,000 homes were damaged, along with about 80% of the area's hotels. Satellite images show the green mountains surrounding Acapulco are now mostly brown from mudflows and debris. Eduardo Mendoza is the Mexico director for direct relief and aid organization working there. We reached out to him at his office in Mexico City. Eduardo, what would it look like to walk down the street in Acapulco right now?
There is lots of damage. Our groups on the ground are saying that essentially most of the buildings are completely devastated. There's a lack of food and water, and that is something that is critical at the immediate moment after the hurricane.
How long are power and water expected to be out? Is there a projection?
We don't know about projections. Right now, what we're hoping is to reestablish power generation at hospitals. I'm in touch with the local authorities of the Mexican Social Security Institute so that we can procure diesel from Chilpancingo, the capital of the state, to ensure that we can get power generation back at the General Hospital in Acapulco, since that is inoperable at the moment. And that is one of the biggest institutions to provide healthcare to all the folks that are still in Acapulco.
So it's not operating at all? There's no backup plan, or if there was, the fuel's out?
That is something that hopefully we can get it back as soon as possible.
You said your organization is focused on medicine. Can you tell me about the need there and what the hiccups are to getting people what they need?
Yeah, the roads were badly damaged on the day and after the hurricane. So the authorities have been working diligently to clean up the roads and the entry. However, safety has been a concern. So we are focused on making sure that the supply lines are adequate. However, we expect total loss for medicine and medical supplies. And so that will be essential over the next coming days to ensure that we get a supply chain of medicines to health facilities as they become more operable. That'll be something that will be needed since the medical stocks were completely destroyed. So we need to make sure that we have a safe infrastructure to ensure that nothing gets stolen on the way there and to ensure that once it arrives, that it can be distributed to the appropriate health authorities to provide those services. Then the next step will also be ensuring that we establish cold chain capacity, which everybody knows due to the pandemic, you know, insulin and other vaccines that are needed will be essential as we move towards, you know, the colder season. We want to make sure that people get access to vaccines, including tetanus and influenza vaccines.
People also may depend on oxygen, things like that. It's been 5 days since the hurricane. Have you heard of folks who have been without, you know, the life-saving medication that they need?
Reports have been scarce because the authorities have been very tight-lipped about the situation. Even though you can't do a full assessment of the health stocks, we can assume that because there's no electricity for 4 to 5 days, that these supplies will be needed immediately and that we need to restock it without really knowing the actual supply there, since, you know, that is something that is always needed. And we know that without electricity, you'll need it.
You mentioned government officials have been rather tight-lipped about what's going on in the storm-affected area. What has the government's response looked like so far?
The government's response has been to focus specifically through the National Defense Ministry. We're in touch with the National Defense Ministry now to ensure that any donations of medicine and medical supplies will be safeguarded when we arrive and ensure that we don't overstep our jurisdiction and make sure that we're informing them of what is coming in. But I think that that's been a challenge for international organizations, is to better understand and coordinate with the authorities on the ground who have been given strict orders to not let other institutions come in and provide support.
The authorities are not allowing other institutions to come in and provide support?
There's been some statements from the president saying that the support and the aid needs to come through the National Defense Ministry and other military authorities. And so that's been something that has created confusion with aid groups, essentially saying, can I get in? If I go in, will I be safe? Mm-hmm. One of the issues I believe that they're doing this is because they can't guarantee your safety, right? And you saw the looting that happened immediately after. And so that is something that we want to make sure that we go in knowing that we will be safe and that we won't be creating additional issues, bringing essentially self-sufficient teams to provide the services that we're going to be providing.
I know the storm got very intense very quickly. Did most people evacuate the area? Are there a lot of people that are still there without these necessary services?
After the storm, a lot of folks were stranded. Airports were completely damaged and inoperable. Roads were completely closed off or flooded or with landslides, and so people couldn't make it out. Those folks will be the most vulnerable because they were already the most vulnerable before and will be in need of assistance right as soon as we can bring that medical assistance to them.
Eduardo Mendoza is the Mexico Director for Direct Relief, which is working to get medical supplies to Acapulco. Eduardo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've got two stories from the world of sports now. In South Africa, there's jubilation after winning the Rugby World Cup this weekend after a nail-biting match against New Zealand. In the matchup between two powerhouses, South Africa snatched victory by just 1 point, the same slim margin that got them through the quarterfinals and semifinals. For the Springboks' first black captain, Siya Kolisi, this was about more than just the game.
People that are not from South Africa don't understand what this means for our country. You know, it's not just about the game on the field. You know, our country goes through such a lot, and we are that bearing hope that they have. And I'm grateful for this team. I'm so proud of it.
Meanwhile, in some corners of Spanish soccer, there might be cheering prompted by a less noble cause. Today, the game's international governing body, FIFA, banned the former Spanish Soccer Federation president from the sport for 3 years. Luis Rubiales was ousted for misconduct at the Women's World Cup final, where he forcibly kissed a player on the lips at the trophy ceremony. Spanish sports editor Alvaro Romeo told a British talk show on Times Radio this could be an opportunity for Rubiales to enter politics, where his macho views are still supported by some.
I think that what Rubiales did was a political act. So I think that he could be very easily integrated in some political context, and why not in some political parties that defend pretty much the ideas that Rubiales has been defending.
Rubiales is also under criminal investigation in Spain, where he denies any wrongdoing. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Marrying Eastern and Western sounds has long yielded musical success. Think George Harrison and the Indian sitar, or more recently, South Korean boy band BTS selling out stadium tours across the U.S. For our next story, it's East meets East. The World's Stephen Snyder previews the debut album of the Aga Khan Master Musicians.
There are 6 members of the group. The reed player comes from Aleppo in northern Syria.
My name is Basir Joub. I play saxophone and duklar.
His music is rooted in the Middle East, but it did not start out that way.
Before having this relation with Oriental music, I wanted to be a jazz musician. And I extremely love Coltrane and Miles Davis. Then at some point, my heart went to the other direction.
Rajoub became one of the founding members of the Aga Khan Master Musicians. The group brings together traditional music from across North Africa and Asia. Members play traditional instruments that are more likely to be found in a museum than on a concert stage, long-necked lutes from Central Asia, the baroque viola d'amore, and the hand drum known as the doira.
All those instruments with a very, very long history.
Wu Man plays the pipa, a plucked string instrument popular in China.
We're culture ambassador, I guess that's the word. We're just bringing the different culture together, show on the stage, and the audience totally get it.
Wu Man, Basil Rajoub, and their bandmates were brought together a decade ago by the Aga Khan Music Foundation. The Aga Khan himself is the wealthy spiritual leader of a branch of Shia Islam with followers in 25 countries. His foundation, based in Geneva, underwrites university programs, art, and cultural organizations around the globe. His master musicians have a stated mission. It's not religious. It's to connect people and cultures through projects like this one. This is Wu Man playing the pipa. She's performed with Philip Glass, with the Kronos Quartet, and she's a founding member of the Silk Road Ensemble with Yo-Yo Ma. She's not Muslim, not from an Islamic culture, but her instrument is.
Pipa came from Central Asia, came from the Islamic world, and the Chinese developed this instrument.
All of us came from countries that improvisation is really important. So it's something that we work the most as musicians for this subject.
Basil Rajoub studied European classical music growing up in Syria. Improvisation was not part of the conservatory curriculum. His professors demanded perfection, European perfection.
Then you come to Arabic music, Middle Eastern music, Balkan music, Ottoman, Turkish, Persian, all of this. The beauty is when you play those
microtones that they are not really perfect and tuned from classical point of view.
Microtones, pitches in between the notes of the rigid Western musical scale.
The beauty and the heart is when you are out of that context, you know, out of that box.
The Aga Khan master musicians have been touring the globe for more than 10 years, but only now have they recorded an album together.
Here you have something absolutely unique, not because of the instrument only. If you think about it, there's no way to put saxophone and doira, dotar and kanun and pipa together. Sound-wise, it's really unusual. But also the musicians themselves, they are completely different.
Musicians from Tunisia, Syria, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and China, a span of 5,000 miles, playing local instruments that are rarely heard on the same stage. Playing together is both a challenge and an opportunity.
So how can we kind of combine together, still keep the traditional roots? That's how we come up with this album.
Wu Man's instrument, the pipa, came from Central Asia, where minor-sounding Middle Eastern modes prevail. But in Eastern China, where she grew up, the pipa is played differently.
Of course, my instrument speaking, I would say, you know, speaking Chinese language, because people understand a lot of a pentatonic sound, like di-da-di-da-da, di-da-di-da-di-da-da. That kind of, you know, oh, that's Chinese music.
Wu Man's composition, Tea House, has a call and answer style, almost like jazz.
I give the melody, sort of like a main melody, and then I kind of pull back.
Wu Man hands her melody over to Farah Shaharistan, who plays the ancient Syrian zither known as the kanun.
And when I join him, we have a conversation. So I give the question and he give the answer. I give the question, he give the answer. Sort of like music talking each other.
Basil Rajoub says that beyond everyone's training, their discipline, and reverence for their traditions, the Aga Khan master musicians share another, more intangible thing.
We play for honor. We have this concept of honor, you know, when it comes to music. I can feel it when I play with Wu Man. Some pieces is like that. Some compositions are like that. Even the stories about music in general. We have a lot of this concept.
And when they play together, the master musicians of Aga Khan, they take us on a journey. The players and their instruments span cultures from the Mediterranean to the South China Sea. When they come together on stage or in the studio, distances and differences fall away. What remains is inspired.
We don't know where is it coming from, if it's from this side or that side. But basically, starting from China to the Arabic world, all of those countries, they had something in common, and every region added some nice things to it, like beautiful stories to it. So this is where you feel that, yeah, there's a Silk Road behind this, you know.
The Aga Khan master musicians, their album is called Nowruz. It's on Smithsonian Folkways, and it's just come out in the U.S. But the music, that echoes across continents and centuries. For the world, this is Stephen Snyder.
Aga Khan master musicians playing us out today. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other out there and join us right back here tomorrow.